we do have a core microbiome which is colonized onto the surface of our skin cells. Similarly, what they are also colonized in gut epithelial mucus layer, as well as the oral surface too. And they do keep changing, depends on what type of environmental exposure we get. But that does not mean the core microbiome did change. Core microbiome change if that exposure is for a long time.
Welcome to the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics. We're a nonprofit scientific organization also known as ISAP. I'm Marla Cunningham, ISAP's Executive Director. This episode is part of our podcast series exploring the skin microbiome. In this series, we speak with experts about some of the latest advances in our understanding of the microbial communities of the skin, including progress towards clinical interventions in dermatology.
So hello, everybody, and welcome to this issue of Science, Microbes and Health podcast with me, Colin Hill.
And I'm Dan Tancredi.
And today's guest, we're delighted to have Haryam Yadav, who's from the University of South Florida. And Haryam works on gut microbiome, the oral microbiome. But today we're here to talk to him more specifically about the skin microbiome, which is another area of interest for him. And Haryam, can you, we asked this with most of the people we've talked about the skin. Can you first tell us what your concept of a skin microbiome is and how permanent is it and how transient is it compared, let's say, to the gut microbiome? I mean, obviously, when we touch things, we pick up bacteria, but we also have a permanent skin microbiome. Can you tell us a little bit about that, please?
Really, first of all, thank you, Colin, and thank you, Daniel, for having me here. So when we talk about this microbiome stability, always the question is, doesn't matter whether it's a skin microbiome, oral microbiome, or gut microbiome. In my, because you're asking my belief and my understanding, as well as the what we have seen constantly in our studies, we talk about two types of microbiome. One is transient, which really keeps changing faster, depends on what type of exposure that microbial community is getting from outside, whether if it's a skin, then what kind of sunlight exposure it is getting, what kind of the body washes we are using, what kind of water exposure is getting, whether someone's, and also the nature of the skin. Someone has like more sweaty, more waxy skin versus someone has the less of that, more dry skin and kind of less of those things, right? And also, really, it also depends on the type of work we do. That does change the microbiome too. So if you look on the construction industry or those folks versus the people who are working in very sophisticated environment or offices are having different microbiome. The people who are working on other types of the environment will have the different type of microbiome. So now coming back to the stable versus the transient microbiome, from our understanding is there is a stable microbiome which we can also call that as a core microbiome, which is normally stably colonized on the skin surface, make the stable biofilms. And depends on the what type of exposure we get, then the certain biofilms expand and actually release or expand a little bit more. But then when you change the conditions of the same persons or the same skin area, some of them will shrink back, some of them will expand back. So I think so that's what you see the changes into the microbiome happens. But otherwise, we do have a core microbiome, which is colonized onto the surface of our skin cells. Similarly, what they are also colonized in gut epithelial mucus layer, as well as the oral surface too. And they do keep changing, depends on what type of environmental exposure we get. But that does not mean the core microbiome did change. Core microbiome change if that exposure is for a long time. But the transient microbiome, you can see those changes from morning to evening. But those changes are not real because they are reversible. Now, the good and bad part is there are so many changes. That's the kind of the people then think about is, okay, how to really control them. But the good part is actually you can change them. Even if they have gone towards a little bit bad, you can bring them to good side. So that's how I think is the good part is it's a modifier.
And so when you're taking a sample, if you want to analyze a skin area of an individual or the same skin area from many individuals, how do you actually take a sample to make sure that you're sampling that core microbiome rather than just the transient microbiome that the person might have picked up on their way in to be tested?
Really great question. And the skin microbiome, what we normally try to do is, first of all, we select some of the different surfaces of the body. There are some surfaces of the body, including the face and our hands and other areas, which are much more exposed to the air and the sunlight. There are areas like the pits and other areas, basically mostly armpits and all, are less exposed, right? So make sure we collect the sample from the two different body sites, or more than that is always good, because the more you collect, the basically it comes in the more stability. The second thing is, when we are taking the sample, we also has to make sure we not rub too hard and too much, but on the same time rub enough where you kind of get that core microbiome. Otherwise, too much surface and too much light will give just only transient microbiome sample, and we might miss the core microbiome sampling in there. So these are the two practices what we use in our microbiome collection. And then the third thing comes in is, if we are recommending to take the microbiome from the other sites, like for example, wounds, that has completely different, because wounds, we cannot control whether wounds is going to be armpit versus the wounds are going to be in the open area. But then taking the microbiome sampling from the active wound area versus the from the surface. So surface can work like a control. Those are the other controls which basically we can use them for, to make sure that we are looking on the same person body, the two different type of microbiome to control.
Mariam, you do a lot of research and you've pioneered research on the role of the microbiome in aging. Can you talk to us about how aging influences the skin microbiome?
Great question. Now, thank you so much for bringing the aging aspect on it. As we all know, the microbiome does change as we grow older. And this is not something we talk about, this change happens when we are retired. No, this change happens even before we born and during our birth canal travel, as well as coming out. And the first 1,000 days are the most dynamic the changes in the microbiome happens. Becomes a little bit stable in case of the gut microbiome, but depends on when we start going to school, goes to college, goes to different workplaces, it keeps changing. When we grow older, it does change. So what I'm trying to say is, there is really the whole dynamic of the microbiome changes happens. Although my research program is mainly focused on the elderly population, so we look onto the how the changes into the microbiome in the 60 plus years old versus the mid-age. Then we also have the collaborators who are also working with us on looking onto the early age. So we look on the early age, mid-age, and the late age microbiome differences, very significant differences. What that tells us is, sometime there are many conditions which develop with the age, especially in the skin-related conditions, are directly correlated with microbiome. Now, again, this chicken egg question always remains, is the microbiome is causing that those conditions, or those conditions are causing the changes into the microbiome. But however, there are several studies done is the transplanting the microbiome from one skin to another skin does transfer those symptoms or those phenotypes or those biological processes. That's what is known, that many times these microbiome are actually contributing in those skin-related conditions. And that also gives the dynamic, like in terms of looking whether we are doing the research or whether we are developing products or technologies. That also gives a different aspect, that the skin microbiome of adolescents or the childs are different than the mid-age versus the older age. So maybe the technologies or the products are coming in there has to be designed more personalized way to kind of have the different ways to work for them.
And Harry, the dogma is, at least, that in the gut microbiome, diversity is king. You know, the more diverse, the better. But with other areas of the body, maybe the vaginal microbiome, the opposite can be true, that the less diverse, the better. You want a more stable but less diverse community. What's the situation on the skin? Or is just referring to the skin too broad a topic? Do you need to talk about different areas of the skin to answer that question?
Great question, Colin. I think so. This is true. Although the skin microbiome is not as defined as the gut and the vaginal microbiome, it has actually, as you said, the different site has the different importance of it. The reason is because certain bacteria does have different properties to grow on the more dead cell and more mucus layer versus the another areas where there are less dead cells in the skin. So if we talk about the example of armpits versus the areas of our body which are more covered versus the areas which are more exposed, has different type of microbes in there. So when we look into the gut microbiome, when we look into the vaginal microbiome is very interesting, enriched with the lactobacilli, and kind of has to have the more the lactobacilli, so more kind of the single type of organism are better in there. However, in the skin, depend on the surface area, which one we are studying. If we are studying skin on the face, having the acne coming out, they are kind of combined with the oil of skin produces versus the sweat, it's kind of exposes there. It does come up with the different type of flavors and flares in there. And it does shows kind of, I would say it's kind of in the middle of vaginal microbiome and gut microbiome. And there are clear indications says that there are similarities of many microbes which grows in the skin also grows into the vagina, as well as the breast microbiome too, which basically is also very important for the baby microbiome acquiring, which they get in early life too.
Can you talk to us a little bit? I know that historically we've concentrated on the predominance of the bacteria, but can you talk to us about some of the insights you've had about the role of other kinds of organisms?
A great question, Daniel. What we have been doing is, unfortunately, skin sampling is not enough to look virome population for us. So what the protocols we could optimize mainly restricted right now up to the gut level. However, the metagenomic analysis, it does give very small signal for the viruses there too in the skin.
And I know that your research, you're very interested in translation, not just simply discovery, and of course that's so important, but in developing interventions like probiotics, postbiotics, even prebiotics to direct it at the skin. Can you tell us something about your work in that area?
Great question again, Colin. So my really research, so just going back on my background, I started working on probiotics from my PhD program when I started in 2001 in India. In the National Dairy Research Institute. And I was mostly working on the probiotics and dairy products at that time. And you know, in 2001, no one heard about the microbiome. Mostly people were just, but probiotics were there, right? Probiotics, prebiotics, concepts were always there. So working on that area, then I came to NIH. Again, that time when I graduating in the 2006, December, that time Jeffrey Gordon's paper came out. And then that's how we all know what the microbiome is today. And then I continued working on the probiotics and the microbiome in NIH. What we have been looking on is, and every time whenever I was going in many seminars, meetings, there was a common question coming is, does really probiotics work? The people who are not in probiotics field will simply ask is, does the supplement really work? What is your opinion? Which one I should take? That really always triggering my curiosity is why people are asking that. Because the probiotics are known to be beneficial. But the reality is if you go into the market level, some of them work, some of them doesn't work. That the reason is because, so then when I start thinking about is what might be the causes for this misconception or the why the people are not believing completely it's working. What I found is actually this is something related to the industry, the way industry actually defines the probiotics. And that was triggered from the definition of probiotics was created by the whole all the scientific community, right? So the definition of the probiotic says is probiotics are live microorganisms, gives the health benefits, right? And then when I was kind of reading more on the Ali Meknikov, how this was probiotic concept came as anti-aging and pro-life, and then basically it came. So now when we are talking about in 2009 and 2010, people not talk about anti-aging probiotics. People just only talk about gut health, immune health, and some other health outcomes. So I started thinking, does the probiotics has to be alive for showing the same concept of what Eli Maknikoff has defined them as a pro-life? So I did actually some experiments where I took the multiple lactobacilli, different species and different strands within the same species. So I wanted to know whether all the lactobacilli can have the anti-aging effect, or is that the some paracasei I might have, but not the rhamnosus versus not the other plantarum or others. That's the reason I selected them and matched them with the different strands. What I found is, first of all, strand-dependent effects comes in, which everyone knows that the probiotics are like that. So not all the paracasei behave the same way. What interestingly I found is, even if you kill them, they still have, some of the strands still have an anti-aging effect. And we have like a big, long story we have developed. We looked into the cell culture system, we C. elegans system, then the mouse models. Now we also have this post. So I created this company in 2018 called Postbiotics Inc. And that Postbiotics Inc. has now commercialized this heat-inactivated bacteria, a heat-inactivated bacteria called Lactobacillus paracasei for anti-aging and longevity indication. So that was kind of my project was started completely a curiosity question and the scientific question to prove that do all the probiotics has to be alive to show anti-aging, because every probiotic product is showing live CFU, live counts. And that actually turns out to be not. Now, we all know that the postbiotic or heat inactivated bacteria brings a lot of different advantages going for the commercial route. Then we also have looked on the skin applications, right? So many probiotics are not feasible to go into the many cosmetic or skin products, because most of those skin products are not favorable for having the live bacteria, because the viability becomes an issue for there. So we kind of then developed the bacterial cell extract to see that whether these bacterial cell extracts can have the benefits in the skin health. Especially, we started with the wound healing, which is kind of a pretty common model as well as pretty common area to start with. And interestingly, we found that some of the probiotic bacterial strands or extracts, so we call them postbiotic, because they are not alive now. They are kind of extracts there, right? So these postbiotics does promote wound healing. But when I translated this to mouse models, what interestingly we have seen is wound healing is a little bit promoted as compared to a betadine, which is a standard wound healing regimen everyone uses, right? But betadine definitely does really, really good job to promote the wound healing. But one thing is common there is when the betadine is applied, it leaves a big scar on that wound because it promotes a lot of collagen formation. And when we put the bacterial extracts, they do promote wound healing, but actually they produce less scar, or some of them have no scar. So we started wondering, is like, why this is happening? You know, yeah. What is making the difference between betadine versus this bacterial? So I was telling the story of to my student is, okay, let's take a simple story so that it sticks in your mind, and we will look on. So I came up with a story saying that is, think about, let's say you are in jungle going for hunting some animal. Now you just fire a one gun shot. What will happen is all the animals will run away, right? Because if you're exactly that's what it happens on the wound area. What happens is when something is got hit on the skin, all the microbes will disperse out. And on the same time, we will also sterilize that with the applying sterile thing, right? So that means we have removed significantly all the microbial exposure around those skin cells, which are basically growing. That's what is causing is basically more fibrogenesis is happening, because there is no microbial stimulation. And microbial stimulations somehow promote natural skin cell growth than the more fibroblast growth. And then we have looked on is the different type of MMPs comes in, different type of the regeneration processes comes in. And these fibroblasts are as aggressive. Actually, they even took over on all the hair follicles and the normal epidermis. So it's basically just the accumulation of the lot of cells comes together because they want to heal this wound as soon as possible rather than going slowly. And this is happening is because they don't sense any microbial sensation there. And what we found is when we apply actually these dead cell bacterial stimulations, that process start getting, although these bacteria are not live, but these are dead bacteria, but their antigens are still giving the signals to these cells, oh, there is a microbes. So they slow down and they carefully kind of fill that gap. That's what
Well, speaking of mechanism, you've done a lot of research where you found the metabolites like butyrate were involved in these mechanisms. So you describe an experiment where you're comparing a postbiotic to an antiseptic. I wonder if you thoughts on experiments where you compare the potentially beneficial metabolites or those being applied directly as opposed to a matrix with postbiotics or probiotics on them.
Great point, Daniel. Now, let me tell you this. These are the two different sites in the body for microbiome. We are talking gut microbiome, very proficient. There are a lot of butyrate producing bacteria. And butyrate is one of the smelly compound. So, and someone can realize flatus smell. Uh-huh. So it's that bad, right? No one wants to have that smell on their skin.
So, no, but I mean, if you were to find the particular metabolite that caused a benefit on the skin in terms of like barrier function or other.
I'm coming on that point. So definitely for the skin, for the gut applications, butyrate has really, really wonderful activity. Everyone knows it. But still, it is like hard to translate it because the butyrate formulations are sodium butyrate, potassium butyrate, and dose you are giving is pretty high. So that brings the limitation of the butyrate application. Otherwise, butyrate could have been the pretty everywhere, right? Now, coming to the skin microbiome, there are very few butyrate producing bacteria. So somehow our skin barriers or skin cells are not in dire need of butyrate because intestinal epithelial cells exclusively use butyrate or salts and fatty acid as an energy source. That's not the case in the barrier cells of skin. Right? So that's the major difference of using butyrate on the skin is not same as the what we will use in the gut epithelial cells because skin cells can use glucose and other sources as the energy source, so they are proficient there. Now, it comes to the barrier functionality in the skin too. I think so that's how these antigenic stimulations and other a byproduct which the skin bacteria makes from either the skin mucus or from the outside exposures, those are really important. Most of them are amino acid derivatives there. So they kind of does influence the barrier function into the skin and they strengthen that or weaken that, depends on what type of the skin bacteria are there or their metabolites are there. But most of them are actually bacterial byproducts, less metabolized, more kind of either proteinaceous in nature, lipid in the nature. Those are the ones which basically are more prominent in case of the skin surface as compared to the gut surface. So these are the major differences what we think are making. So that's how applying directly the bacterial cells or bacterial cell extracts will give the much more robust effect than the metabolites because metabolite can sway certain bacteria because they can feed only certain bacteria and then the other bacteria might not be impacted. So these metabolites depends on whether they are working on bacterial cells and they become the substrate of food for those bacteria or they are working directly on the skin cells. But we know that if we apply for the bacterial extracts, they most likely are not going to work on bacteria. Most of them, they will work on host cells. And then the host cell response will feed back to the skin bacteria, either in the form of feeding more mucin or more type of the different secretions, which basically will modulate the microbiome in the skin.
Really fascinating stuff, Harry. And I think we could talk for another half an hour just as productively, but unfortunately, we've come to the end of our time. So I want to really thank you for joining us and for giving us your insights. It's been wonderful talking to you.
No, thank you. I too. It's really, really great to meet you here. And thank you for having me here.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from ISAP. If you've been enjoying the show, please follow and rate our podcast to help support our continued work. You can also send us your feedback, questions or topic suggestions by emailing info@isapscience.org and check the show notes for links and further information on this topic.